afternoon, and welcome to the second half of We the People Radio here on October the 12th, 2025. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff.
And we have Alan Gelso with us. Yay. I read the snippet about his books some time back, and I thought, we have to cover this. And I'm positive he can't do this in a minute and a half, so we have an entire hour minus commercial, little commercial breaks, but the title of the book, actually, is The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition, and it's a two-volume set. I believe it is a textbook. He is the Thomas W. Smith Distinguished Research Scholar in the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions and a faculty member at Princeton University. He's the co-author of this new textbook, The Golden Thread. I just think that this is something, the timing is so great. And the title of the article that was sent to me said, "Why are Americans ignorant of our own history?" I thought, amen, right? Yeah. Let's get him on there. And then I searched for some pictures, as I told you last week, and I found this one wearing a dashing red tie and kind of a smirk. So Alan, the picture I'm looking at of you has a little smirk on it, and I understand last week you were moving. I'm sure your smirk was gone by the end of that ordeal.
Well, I'm surprised that I would smirk. Usually I'm a pretty sober-looking character.
I know. That's why I picked the smirky one. You kind of look a little bit like Kelsey Grammer. It's kind of that sort of smirk.
Oh, dear. If I had a dime for every person who has asked me over the last 30 years, do you know that you look like Fraser?
It's pretty funny. I mean, it's like, yikes.
I know, and I've had more than a few interesting events occur. Probably the most interesting was the day I walked into a news agency. I was going to buy a newspaper. The man behind the counter looked at me and said, "You're Fraser, aren't you?" And I said,
"You're all,
no."
Yeah.
I said, no. And then he responded by saying, "Oh, I understand. You can't say that in public." and then he dived down below the counter and came up with a camera and took my picture.
Nice.
So suddenly I had celebrity thrust upon me.
I like it. Well, you know the Kelsey Grammer, like, kind of little half smile. Picture is that, and I thought, that is just fun. Especially for someone who wrote a book about the history of the world. I mean, I figured, well, you know.
The curious thing is, I've never met Kelsey Grammer. Maybe someone in your listening audience can broker some kind of rapprochement between us. But I've never met the man. And this makes it even stranger. I've never watched any of the shows that he has been in because I'm just not a television watcher.
Sure.
I wouldn't have the time.
Even if you're on the show.
So to speak. So when people would say things like that to me, I wasn't entirely sure. Is that a compliment or an insult? Well, I finally figured out, all right, it's a compliment. So I'm reasonably content for people to ask me that question without biting anybody's head off.
Well, the good part is at least he's smart. I mean, it wasn't one of those comedies that was a bunch of, intestinal jokes,
right,
or whatever.
It's
actually a very smart show, and it was very funny. But I just kind of chuckled because we interviewed a guy. His topic was very sober too. He was a murder investigator, and there's a picture of him, and he looks like 007. And I was like,
oh my goodness!
I love knowing
people
just through their pictures on the internet. It's kind of fun.
It can be a little risky. You might draw the wrong conclusion.
I know.
If a photographer catches someone at the wrong angle or at the wrong moment, and that can send all kinds of shockwaves through the blogosphere.
Yeah, so I kind of go through the, just look at the preponderance of the pictures, and yours were very serious, but this one was fun, and I thought, we're fun, so you'll be fun, and this would be a good representation for this.
I will, as Jeeves said, I will do my best to give satisfaction.
Exactly. Okay, so is there an answer, or is it a two-volume answer to why are Americans ignorant of our own history? Did you ever get to the root of that?
I think we addressed that actually pretty frankly right at the very beginning in the introduction to the two-volume set. The two volumes were written by myself. Actually, I wrote the bulk of Volume 2, and Volume 1 was written by my co-author and friend of many, many years, James Hankins of Harvard. Hankins and I have known each other since, quite literally, since high school. And not only that, we were even in marching band together, believe it or not. So we have a long history over these five decades and more of constant conversation. And when someone asked me, how long did it take you two to write this? The answer was like, well, you know, we've really been at this for about the last 50 years. So the actual mechanics of writing, maybe about 5 years. But the issues, the questions, all of these things are things we have talked about for all of those years. So what we have tried to address and had to address, both in the books and in our professional lives, is this question, why don't people know more about history? And I think there's several reasons for that. One is that there has occurred a crisis of sorts in this thing we call Western civilization. There's a kind of indifference. Because we have learned by means of mass communication, we've learned how big the world is, and we feel that we have to accommodate all of it to do justice to it. And in accommodating all the other histories that it's possible to accommodate, we have to make some room and shorten the attention span that's devoted to Western history and to American history in particular. Sometimes the indifference, though, is there because there are people who believe that all history is really just superstructure. It really isn't about real things like the acquisition of power or economic forces. And then there's sometimes, quite frankly, there are people who are just simply openly hostile to Western civilization, to American history in particular within Western civilization, because they blame it for quite a grocery list of evils, genocide, colonialism, imperialism, slavery, racism, sexism, as though these were not present in other places, which of course they are. It's not that these are unique in the experience of Americans or in the experience of Western civilization. So I think in many respects, there are a multitude of reasons for this moment when we feel like we have suffered from a kind of cultural Alzheimer's and our memory has gone blank, or if not entirely blank, at least mostly blank, about the things that are really very important for us. So these two books are really a recall. They are a stimulation, a revitalization of our memory of who we are and how we got to where we are. And that's why we focus our title on one particular famous myth from Greek classical history. The Golden Thread is really about how Theseus finds his way out of the labyrinth after he has slain the evil Minotaur. The Golden Thread is what he finds as his passageway out of the labyrinth into the light of day. And what we are encouraging people to do through these books is, once again, find a way out of the darkness of the labyrinth into which we've allowed our memory to lapse, and follow that golden thread to the light, to the present, to our current situation, and bring with it all the riches of the past in terms not just of history, but also of culture, of literature, of art. These two books, these are big books. They're big because they're chock full of illustrative material, of art, of charts, of primary sources. In a sense, we want people to be able to dip into these books and have a sense that they are meeting their own civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm always fascinated by history, and one of the things that I think people kind of lose sight of is when you talk about world history, I mean, written history goes back forever. our history is only 250 years old. You go beyond that and the things that were going on in the world prior, I mean, 1500, 1400, 1300, it's all written down. And we weren't even... We weren't in the game. We weren't even in the game. We weren't even thought of when all this was happening. And that always just kind of fascinates me when you put it in perspective.
Look at it in the long term. And we are still in what you might call, as a nation, our adolescence.
Yeah.
Sometimes with all the problems of adolescence, adolescents don't have a particularly good grasp, let's say, on the experience of their parents. In fact, by the time you get to 14, 15, 16, 17, hey, you don't want to be seen doing the things your parents did. You really don't think that the experience of your parents is all that relevant to you and your friends.
Right.
Then you get a little bit older. You go to school. You acquire a life of your own. And as Mark Twain once said, it is absolutely amazing how much your parents have learned by the time you turn 22.
That is so true.
Yeah, they get smarter as you get older.
They really get smarter.
Yeah. So in this case, what we are in is a kind of intellectual adolescence. And what these books are a way of doing is helping us get to the mature stance that understands exactly how we got where we are today, and what we have gained by it, and also what we've lost along the way, and can and should retrieve. So these books are a guide, cast in the form of history, of two volumes worth of history, because both Hankins and I are historians, professionally speaking. But it's also a recovery of the whole notion of what it is to be part of a civilization. And simply unpacking the word civilization gives us some fairly good ideas of what is contained in that effort.
Well, who and where will this, where will your textbook, is it an option for, you know, universities? I realize people can actually, regular people that aren't in college can buy it, but...
Yeah, in large measure, Hankins and I have aimed the books themselves for students in upper division high school surveys, AP surveys of various sorts, maybe 11th if they're really, really good, but 12th grade, or for first-year college surveys. And we've already had inquiries from colleges and universities who are thinking about adopting the Golden Thread for Western Civilization survey courses. So that is the audience that we're really looking at, although, truth be told, these are the kind of books that can really be picked up by almost anyone. You don't have to be 18, 19, 20. You can be two or three times that and still pick these books up and find elements of interest in the narrative, in the excerpts from the original sources, in the artwork that is reproduced here and discussed, even the discussion of music. Now, in a book, you can't play music, but in a book, you can describe music. So, for instance, in Volume 2, I have separate sections talking about Claudio Monteverdi, talking about Giovanni Gabrieli, about Tchaikovsky, about Brahms, about Wagner. I devote, in fact, a whole chapter to the individual whom I consider the greatest of Western musicians in anything remotely related to modern times, and that is Johann Sebastian Bach. So all of these things are in these books, and they are there for anyone at any age level to access. So art, music, and the historical narrative, these are all combined in these volumes.
I think, honestly, I think it's really worth hitting home the fact that we have lost track of some of our history, and some of it is, well, I'll be kind. How about it's not being taught accurately? There's a little bit of that going on, a lot of that going on, which is sparking all sorts of revolutionary ideas that aren't really revolutionary. They're just kind of based on lack of historical knowledge. Maybe we can hit that when we come back. Sorry, I just looked at the time. We have to take a really quick break, but we're going to be back. with Alan Gelzo, and the books that he has written with James Hankin, Hankins, The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition, of the Western Tradition. And stick with us. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's our time to take a stand. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
There's a call across this land. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
We were a city on a hill, a candle in the dark. It started. To be free. Remember who we are. With our blood, sweat and tears. Remember who we are. Will our children be the ones asking us one day why we didn't do enough, why we gave it all away?
So your book might not have any music in it, but we found some. And
well, that worked. There's a message there, and the message is who we are is who we were.
Yeah.
And a sense of understanding that is critical to the life of any society. I remember many years ago, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his great opus, The Gulag Archipelago, made the comment that the first strategy of tyrants and dictators is to erase the history of the people that they conquer.
Yep.
Because then people have nothing to compare the past and the present with. They have no way of looking at their current situation and saying, look, this is wildly different and much worse than it was in the past. And if you don't have that as a guide, if you don't have that as an incentive, then you're not going to trouble the waters for the tyrants and the dictators who are ruling you. And that's, of course, exactly what the tyrants and dictators want. They want to erase the past because it gives you no basis of comparison for understanding your situation in the present.
Yes, and I would imagine it's very difficult since you've spent so much time caring about and researching and documenting all of these things. It's probably pretty tough to watch the conclusions that some of our, especially college-age students, have found with communism and all of those things. It's like,
oh yeah, yeah.
Like you want to just bang your head on a table. It's like, have you never read anything? What the heck?
Well, sometimes the answer to that question is no, they haven't.
sometimes it's right in front of our face, isn't it?
Right, but let me take a step beyond that. Yeah, that's sort of a knee-jerk response. I want to be perfectly frank and say that there are things that have happened in the experience of the Western nations, which is to say Europe, the United States, and all of the, let's call them the appendages of European civilization, Australia, New Zealand, South America. There are things that have happened in the life of just the last century and two decades, that are pretty nasty affairs. Two world wars, some shameless exploitation, And in that respect, it's no wonder that guilt and pity play such a large role in the way people are educated today and are instructed to be ashamed of the past of their own cultures. And so it's not difficult to come up with a bill of indictment. You can put a lot of things on it, all the way from the Western Front in 1914 to 1918, to atomic bombs in World War II, to the concentration camps and the Holocaust, to the Gulag. And you can look at everything that's happened in the last 100, 120 years, and you could say, goodness sakes, this thing called Western civilization really looks like a crock. So if people are disenchanted, there are some good reasons. On the other hand, in the past of Western civilization, there have also been moments of great loss when it looked like the whole thing was going to come apart. When the Roman Empire collapsed, it really seemed at that moment that everything that had gone into the making of the Western tradition, which is to say the civilization of the Greeks, the civilization of the Romans, was going to be hopelessly lost. And in fact, we did lose large chunks of it. But we managed to get by, as Kenneth Clark remarked many years ago, by the skin of our teeth. We recovered those elements of civilization that were so close to being lost. All right, that was one occasion. Another occasion was after the Great Plague of the 14th century, which costs the life of something like two-thirds of the European population. And we talk about a pandemic, and we talk about people getting shots and masks. Well, there weren't shots, and there weren't masks, and the bubonic plague was infinitely more deadly than COVID. That was a moment when, once again, Western civilization seemed just to teeter on the brink of dropping into the abyss. Mm-hmm. And we almost did it again, 300 years later, with the religious wars of the 17th century, and especially the great 30 Years' War, when it seemed like everyone had forgotten what it was to be civilized and was behaving like barbarians. So there have been these moments in the past, but we have recovered from them. And we are looking at a moment when, yes, there has been, over the last century, a lot of the same loss. But we can recover this again. And it is important for us to recover the great things of Western civilization, because the alternative to civilization, quite literally, is barbarism. And do we want to be ruled by something we would call barbarism? I would define barbarism fundamentally as the worship of power.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have to characterize that worship of power, what it involves in is total loss of self-control. Everyone just behaves according to impulse, and usually very destructive impulse. There's the development of destructive religions, sometimes anti-religions, and we can see this as an aspect of barbarism. Another way that you can talk about barbarism is about illiteracy. Illiteracy, and with illiteracy, indifference to the past. Because what else is literacy but a way of holding off indifference and loss of memory of the past? That's why we write things down, because you and I can't remember everything. And even the things we do remember are going to perish with us. Why do we write things down? Because we want the things that are written to endure. But barbarism takes that as an enemy and destroys it.
Right.
And I think above all, barbarism looks a certain way. Barbarism looks ugly. It's ugliness in art, it's ugliness in literature, it's ugliness in music, it's ugliness in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things fundamentally are based on a worship of power. And that's what constitutes barbarism. Is that what we want to live under? I don't think so.
No.
So if we want to escape the appeal of barbarism, and the appeal of barbarism is out there, all you got to do is look out the window, mm-hmm. and you can see the examples of the threat of barbaric thinking. If we want to avoid being ruled by barbarism, then the alternative is civilization, at which point you want to say, all right, tell us about civilization. That's what these two books are about.
Do you think, you talk about these periods of great loss, Do you think civilization needs to go through those periods of great loss in order to kind of regroup and come back stronger and better?
That would almost be like saying that it's good for a human body to go through cholera, smallpox, and malaria in order to become stronger.
Right, right. But we continue to do it.
Well, yes, but we don't do it as a plan. We don't say, okay, we're 12 years old. Now, here's smallpox. This will be good for you, whether you like it or not. That's really not what we do. We understand that there are better ways to live. And especially when we think about what it costs to make a comeback. I mean, on the one hand, yes, you can say it's a remarkable feature of the Western tradition that it has the kind of resilience that allows it to stage these recoveries. That's really remarkable in its own right. But the price that that gets paid along the way, that's not something you want to invite. You might want to say, I'm not sure I want to endorse it, but you might want to say, well, this is inevitable. Everything goes through this kind of cycle. Yes, perhaps, but even if you grant the legitimacy of talking about cycles in history, it's not a pleasant thing that you want to invite on people. And above all, what if the cycle goes off the rails? What if, in fact, the cycle becomes so destructive that the civilizational values themselves, this time, get completely lost?
Right.
That's not a chance you want to take. It's not an era that you want to live through.
No, that's an excellent point. You know, you hear people talk about, you know, they think they have it terrible right now, which I have a hard time with. But, oh, we're going to go through another civil war. We need another civil war to get this straightened out. Where's that come from? I mean, it was so destructive. I mean, we're still feeling the effects of the last Civil War, and yet people want to go through that again. How do you explain that?
Well, I think sometimes it's because they're trying to think of the most readily available cataclysm that Americans have experienced, and the one that pops up most easily on the screen is the Civil War. They might just as easily say the Great Depression or the First World War. But they come up with the Civil War because that's what comes up most readily.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have another Civil War? I'm very dubious about this. At least, we're not going to have a Civil War in the same sense that we had it in 1861.
Right. No, there's no way.
Yeah, we're not marching around with single-shot, muzzle-loading muskets that fire black powder. That's not going to happen.
Well, every person who ever tells me that, I finally stopped having the, you know, getting into the weeds on, you know, what the mechanics, and I just cut right to the chase. Okay, let's agree we're having it. Starts tomorrow. What's that look like?
Most of the time we couldn't say.
And then the silence ensues, and the debate is over, and they realize, we're probably not doing that.
Right. It sounds profound to talk about. It even sounds impressive, but is there any substance in it? No. Now, having said that, is it possible we would go through a period of great political disruption? Now, that's another story.
Yeah.
And that becomes a possibility that we all have to think about and we all have to cope with. I think fundamentally, the American imagination is so thoroughly wedded to this idea of democracy, is so thoroughly wedded to its constancy and its survival, that I don't think Americans are going to cheerfully throw that away and say, simply because I disagree with my neighbor, ergo, I'm going to draw an international boundary line around the backyard. That is not going to happen. It's not practicable, and it's not even really feasible.
So how do you explain this shift in our political landscape towards socialism, when you look at the history of socialism, communism, whatever you want to call it, it always fails, and yet we have so many people that are willing to look at that and
they,
go,
their answer is always, we just didn't do it. They just didn't do it right.
Yeah, we'll do
we
it.
We could do it a different way.
Right. So another million casualties.
Right.
It's going to sound peculiar for me to put it this way, but this is one of the casualties of historical ignorance.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Because what makes the communist alternative compelling to people? Is it because it has demonstrated great economic success? Right, sure.
Zero chance there.
Even if we say, all right, we're going to have it in a somewhat modified form, we're going to have the great socialist experiment. Fine, take a look at the great socialist experiments. Tell me how much great economic success there is. Now, people will sometimes pop up and say, yeah, but look at Britain, the National Health Service. Everybody gets free health care. Well, yeah, everyone gets free health care approximately 3 months after they're dead.
Yeah.
So what exactly is it we're talking about? Why? It's not the practical results of socialism or communism that attract people. It's a theory of history. Because what else is Marx? I mean, everything else that Marx described in his writings that speaks to economics has failed. But one thing which abides, and that is the appeal of Marx saying, I know why historical change happens. Historical change happens because there's change in the economic forces at work in the lives of cultures and countries. What are the great markers, historically speaking? Well, there was feudalism, and then there was this bourgeoisie, this middle class, and the middle class overthrew feudalism and replaced it with capitalism. All right, what's going to happen next? The working class is going to overthrow the bourgeoisie and capitalism, and it's going to set up the socialist paradise. Of course, Marx never said what might happen after that, but what people have been enchanted by is this notion that Marx has given them the explanation for why things have occurred in the past and why they are going to occur in a certain pattern in the future. Fundamentally, economics is not what makes Marxism attractive, because there's been so many failures. What continues to make Marxism attractive is it offers to explain why events change in history, and they change because they change on the basis of economic forces and the movement of economic forces and economic classes. It is the enchantment, so to speak, of that historical vision which keeps Marxism alive for people, even when they know very well that there's no economic substance, no economic theory, nothing that is going to guarantee the prosperity of people. To the contrary, it's not prosperity that they're after. What it is a sense of being on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm.
And given that as its attraction, people will embrace that. They will throw away the other histories of their nations and of their civilization to embrace the Marxist theory of history. If you would like to put Marxism in the refrigerator where it never needs to come out again, then the way to do it is to strike at it as a theory of history, as an understanding, as a way of explaining history, because that is the thing which keeps it alive.
Mm-hmm. How do you...
Because there is no free lunch.
No.
And so they're always promising all these things that...
Well, and everybody likes free stuff.
Are never
know?
Coming.
Yeah,
yeah, we're going to do all these free things. And it's like, it always blows my mind that adults will fall for that. Because where in our lives is that even true? Oh my gosh, it's 1:41. Alan, you're causing us to time travel. I hope
Sorry
you're.
About
I
that.
Hope you're happy.
Well, that's sort of part of my job description.
That's where the smirk comes in. That's what's happening. We are experiencing that. All right, we've got to take another really quick break. We're going to come right back. Our guest is Alan Gelzo, and the book is not The History of the World Part 2, but that's what I hear in the back of my mind, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. And it's a two-volume set, and I think we should make everyone read it.
Yeah, it should be.
Let's talk
mandatory.
About freedom and force everyone to read a book. So, really quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh,
see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Ah, yes. Until you delve into the details.
Yeah. Let me take off my rose-colored glasses here. I have a question. How do you see the, you know, with all this advanced technology that's coming on board, seems like daily we're hearing of new tech, how do you see that influencing or guiding the direction of our society?
So you want him to write a third book about the future?
No, but everything seems to be moving so fast right now. And I know every civilization and every era has its own technology. But I'm just curious with what we, you know, with the AI and computers and so forth, where do you see that guiding us?
Well, it's curious because as Robert Fulton's steamboat, the Clermont, was beating its way up the Hudson River at about 6 miles an hour, people on the deck of the Clermont were possessed with panic. We've never gone this fast before.
Yeah.
All right, 6 miles an hour, okay? At that point, that was what really seemed to be almost impossible for people to achieve, much less to be able to continue to breathe. And yet we got over it pretty quickly. Technological change has always been with us, especially it's been with us over the last 300, 400 years. And in particular, since the middle of the 19th century, with the development of the electrical telegraph, we've moved more and more and more towards electronic-based innovations. And we will continue to do that. They will disturb us at moments, the same way they disturbed, the same way the electrical telegraph disturbed people when it was introduced, when the telephone was introduced only a few decades after that. But when you lit up cities with the incandescent light bulb, that was disturbing in its own right. Yet at the same time, we learn how to accommodate and work around these things. Is there going to come a moment in the development of technology today when we somehow we are not able to, when the technology finally defeats us? I think that is going to require more of a prophet than I am to say, because there's a good deal in the world of modern technological developments which is very problematic. Look at the amount of time people devote to screens, especially adolescents,
mm-hmm.
and look at the damage it does. The studies that have been done about the rates of anxiety and depression that are generated by kids who are glued to their smartphones all the time, this is serious and it's disturbing. Is it, however, the end of an age? That, I think, remains to be seen. We have encountered extraordinary technologies before, and they've changed tremendous amounts in short periods of time in people's lives. But we have found ways of accommodating those changes, and we found ways of internalizing coping mechanisms for them. So if we've done that in the past, all right, let's wait and see. We may find exactly those ways for the future. That is as much as a peek behind the curtain of the future as I think anybody can decently give. Otherwise, a great deal of this becomes doomsaying. Because doomsaying, well, frankly, doomsaying gets more attention. If I tell you that tomorrow everything is going to be cool, are you going to sit up nights worrying about it? Are you going to do something about it? No. But if I tell you that tomorrow there's going to be an electromagnetic pulse that's going to fry up every piece of electronic equipment on planet Earth, you are going to do things, and probably you're going to buy things that I tell you to buy. There's much more of a profit margin to doom than there is to peace. This is why people peddle doom much more vigorously than they peddle peace.
Oh, sure. I look at you know, when you talk about the smartphone technology, I think part of the reason people aren't as educated in history in the past is they don't have to be. They can pick up their cell phone and they can, if somebody asks them a question, you know, they can look it up. AI will tell them the answer in seconds, you know, so.
It'll be the wrong answer, but.
yeah, but they won't know that.
Well, this is true.
Ignorance is bliss, volume 3.
But I think that's where I think it's, I don't want to say dumbing down, but I think that's exactly what's happening to a lot of our society, and particularly our younger generation.
I'm going to push some chips on the table and say Alan concurs.
Yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. Is it not strange that today we have simultaneously this extraordinary obsession with technology and technological development, at the same time as we have a real loss of belief and confidence in science?
Yes.
So that you have theories of science which completely subvert any notion of predictability, any notion of regularity. I can get into the weeds on some of this. I can, you know, drop names like Heisenberg and Thomas Kuhn and people like that. It's the sort of thing that provoked the response from Einstein, that his protest, God does not play with dice. And yet, all of our notions of science today and philosophy of science seem to be marching away from any confidence or belief at the same time as we're putting all our chips in the development of various kinds of technology. Of course, now all the current craze is for AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I don't. I guess it's like any generation that is confronted with new technology. It is a little frightening, and
all the more reason in that case. All the more reason to come back to this idea of picking up the golden thread of the Western tradition. I mean, and we use, by the way, we use the word tradition rather than civilization, because the Western tradition is really a collection of civilizations. You might think of it as kind of archaeological layers. So there is a Greek civilization that we begin with the Battle of Marathon. And then piled on top of that, absorbing that, is the Roman civilization. Then on that, the medieval civilization. Then on that, the civilization of the Enlightenment, and so on. So there is a tradition, because all of these civilizations work together as layers in the creation of this tradition. And I think it's important that we recover that as a counterbalance to the obsession with technology, to the threat of barbarism, because what this Western tradition does is it puts us back to language and literature, puts us back to the written word, it puts us back to decision-making, to what's sometimes called the argument for the sake of heaven. It puts us back to government and law, and the impulse for freedom, and it puts us back to faith and art, and above all to resilience, because the great thing about this Western tradition over and over again at its moments of crisis is the capacity that it has shown for self-criticism and for renewal. And it's building on that capacity for self-criticism, of acknowledging, yes, in the Western past, in the American past, there have been some dreadful mistakes. There have been some embarrassing, dreadfully embarrassing moments. Nevertheless, over and over again, our capacity for self-criticism has allowed us to turn those moments of embarrassment, of almost self-contradiction, into forces for the good. So take all those things together, and this Western tradition is something that we need in an environment when barbaric attitudes, the worship of power, and the obsession with technology threaten to overwhelm us. That is why the Western tradition, we have the imperative here to recover its strengths and its virtues, because it is that which time and again in the past have rescued us from the abyss and can rescue us again from an abyss of the worship of power and the obsession with technology. So that's why these books are here. to help us along the path of that golden thread.
I think, and here at the end of what we got from Stephen Manfredi, your publicist, he just always finds us the most amazing people. People ask all the time, where do you find all these people? I'm like, I don't. I just have friends. Viva la friends. So this he says here, as Gelzo and Henkins conclude, this indeed is the great test that Western civilization faces in our time. We need to find a new balance between tradition and innovation, to modernize with moderation without losing that inheritance of immeasurable value that we call the Western tradition. And it's like, yes, that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think that is something that rings true, would ring true for most people, and yet so much of it has become... it's like the addiction to noise.
I think that if people could sometimes sample the extraordinary products of a great Italian chef, they would suddenly say, why haven't I ever had a dinner like this before?
Mm-hmm.
Or if they were to sample some marvelous French wine, they would say, why have I never encountered something like this before? I think they could do the same thing by encountering the literature of great writers and the art of great artists and the music of great musicians from the Western past. A lot of the times we're scared to do that. If I were to tell you that I'm going to give you an assignment from Boccaccio's Decameron, you would probably think, oh my goodness, I'm going to get a quiz on this tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. How am I ever going to cope with it? Because that stuff is so highbrow, and I am so lowbrow, I could never hope to scale the cliff. Well, you know something? If you pick up the Decameron, I'm just using that as one example from the 14th century.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick up a good translation of the Decameron, I guarantee you in 10 minutes you'll be hooked by the thing. Why? Because Boccaccio was writing it for people just like you. He wasn't writing it for professors.
Yeah.
He wasn't writing it for people coasting along at the 30,000-foot intellectual level. No, because there really aren't that many people there. But Boccaccio is writing this as a chronicle of what he went through. And the same thing is true of all the great writers. The great literature that Hankins and I examine in these books and offer you examples from, they're really like those small samples of great dishes that you might get at a fair, let's call it a restaurant fair. You go there and the restaurants have these little samples of the best cooking that they offer. All right, that's what these books are. We're going to give you the best samples of the Western tradition. And what you're going to find is, hey, this stuff was written for us. Because
yeah.
It was.
Yeah, their audience was regular people. My mother was a professional cellist, and my mother believed that, and she was correct, that music spoke to everyone. You didn't need to know who the composer was. Like, my brother used to fall asleep all the time, and we were horrified because here we were sitting right below. She played first chair, and we were sitting right below the cello section, and here my brother's out cold. And she just always smiled, and she said, he's enjoying it in his own way. And so, you know, musicians see that, historians see that, and I think sometimes we don't spend enough time with all of you.
Well, I think sometimes those of us who are part of the professoriate sometimes make more grief than we need to. Sometimes what we really have to do is remember that what we're doing is we're introducing strangers to each other. We're introducing people today to people they've never met from the past. And if you were in a position like that, if you were about to introduce to, you know, someone who lives down the hall or next door, someone, let's say, from perhaps Nepal, if you were going to introduce that to one of your that person like that from to one of your neighbors, how would you go about doing it?
Yeah.
And as soon as you put it that way, that's really the task that Hankins and I have set for ourselves in this book. How do we introduce you
to
a treasure
I hate to unceremoniously end our chat, but the radio is going to do it for us. But I really do want to pick this up and do this again because there's so much more to discuss. And we really appreciate you. The Golden Thread, The History of Western Tradition. You can find all the information about our guest in the book at WeThePeopleRadio.us.